Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames. Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. Explains it in a way that's easier to understand. This season, we're tackling the cost of learning. Over the past 5 weeks, we've learned a lot about the way we pay for Ohio's public K-12 schools. But above all of the things that I've learned, one stands out. School funding is complicated. It certainly is an issue where everyone has an opinion, but no one seems to have the perfect solution. Today, we're bringing you a bonus 6th episode of Untangled, because I was able to get interviews with 2 Ohio lawmakers to get their perspective on how we got where we are and what happens next. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Republican State Senator Louis Blessing and Democratic State Representative Bride Rose Sweeney. But first, I want to recap the last 5 episodes briefly.
The issue here is really, does the state really want to meet its constitutional responsibility? They would have come to a constitutional system had they fully implemented the Cupp-Patterson program from the very beginning when they adopted it.
That's William Phyllis from the Ohio Coalition for Equity and Adequacy of School Funding. He's the one who brought the lawsuit to the Ohio Supreme Court about 30 years ago when the court ruled the state school funding system unconstitutional. So he thought the Fair School Funding Plan, also known as the Cupp-Patterson Plan, was close to being a success. Aaron Churchill, Ohio Research Director for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a conservative think tank that researches education policy, has a different take on the goal of the Fair School Funding Plan.
I think what Cupp-Patterson was trying to do was increase the amount of funding overall that goes to public education. So even more than what we spend today, we spend $30 billion on public schools. And what this formula was trying to do was increase that even more.
He says the plan was expensive from the start and is expensive to maintain. Not everyone agrees with Churchill's assessment.
You had a guest on your first show that I think completely mischaracterized that plan as saying it was all about getting more funding for education. That could not be more incorrect. Mm. It was about going back to what the court explicitly said the state needed to do with the school funding formula, which is determine the parameters based on what it costs, not what the state is willing to put into the bucket.
That's Howard Fleeter, an economist and research consultant at the Ohio Education Policy Institute. He has consulted for both Republican and Democratic administrations over the past several decades in Ohio. He also pointed out,
I've gone back to 1999, which was the first year of the response to the DeRolf decision. We have never had a year where the state share of the base cost has been less than 40% until last year.
That's the problem. The system is out of balance. The state share is going down. The local share is going up, mostly by way of property taxes. And that imbalance is what we spent other parts of the series talking about. We talked with school districts with levies on the ballot this November. We talked with superintendents from urban, suburban, and rural districts to get their perspective. We also learned how things are done in other states and other countries. Finland does a really great job with its schools, by the way. As far as other states go, Wyoming and Alaska do a good job using their profits from natural resources to educate their very rural school kids, while Massachusetts and New Jersey have done well in targeting more resources to areas of higher need. But it appears that nobody has it figured out completely. Be sure to listen back to the first 5 episodes of Untangled: The Cost of Learning. You can find the shows wherever you get your podcasts. And they're all available at WOSU.org/untangled. Coming up, we'll hear from Senator Blessing and Representative Sweeney. That's when Untangled from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, explains it in a way that's easier to understand. This season, we're tackling the cost of learning. Paying for Ohio schools is a complicated system that combines money from the state with money from local communities. Everyone seems to agree that the burden of paying for schools is falling disproportionately on local communities in the form of increasing property taxes. But the way to fix that imbalance depends on who you ask. Some say the state needs to pay more. Others say school districts need to trim their budgets and spend more wisely. Still others say that more choice in the form of private and charter schools is the way to go. Joining us now with his thoughts on how to pay for Ohio's public K-12 schools is Senator Louis Blessing. He's a Republican senator from Southwest Ohio, the area around Cincinnati in Hamilton County. He's also the vice chair of the Senate's Education Committee. Senator, welcome to All Sides.
No, thank you. I'm happy to be here, Amy.
All right. So I have heard from multiple people during the course of this series that the Cupp-Patterson, also known as the Fair School Funding Plan, that bipartisan bill that passed back in 2021, was the closest we've gotten in decades to having a constitutional school funding formula. So what did you think of the Cupp-Patterson plan? Was it a good one?
Yeah, I do think it's a good plan. And there's a lot of context that we need to remember here. So, you know, yes, it is, you know, going to be fully phased in after this most recent budget, which admittedly I voted against, which I can get into later. But there's a lot of components of that formula that were not put into place in the budget, particularly with respect to inputs, which are largely speaking, you know, teacher salaries and those things that make up the cost to a school. But yes, I do support the Fair School Funding Formula. I think it's deeply necessary, and it really will help the out of whack split between state and local funding for public education.
Now, you mentioned that you voted against the budget. Was it because, as you said, the Fair School Funding Plan was not fully implemented? Is that your main reason?
Well, I would say it's probably the biggest reason, although it wasn't obviously the only reason. Mm-hmm. And to give you a little bit of context in what's going on here, Ohio ranks, and this I got from LSC, which that's the Legislative Service Commission, that is our bill drafting and research arm, that showed that Ohio ranked 37th in the country in terms of, and this is key, state level per pupil public education funding. Mm-hmm. However, local level per pupil funding, we were 15th in the country. When you add all that up with federal dollars, which are admittedly a much smaller portion when you compare it to state and local, we were right in the middle, 25th. But when you look at our surrounding states, and this is for FY23, we were the lowest of all of our surrounding states in terms of state level per pupil public education funding. And in FY23, had we done the entirety of the Fair School Funding Formula, all the updated inputs as envisioned by the Fair School Funding Work Group, we still would have been the lowest amongst our surrounding states, although we would have been right on the heels of West Virginia. So for me, it was imperative that we increase the amount of state-level funding, which, you know, as I'm sure you've probably talked to, you know, school superintendents and treasurers and whatnot, they don't like going to the ballot. Nobody likes going to the ballot. But if the state is pitching more money in, I think the net effect would have been that 37th ranking would have increased. And by the way, had we done this in FY23, we'd rank 30th. But I also think that that 15th in local level funding would have dropped closer to the middle, which ultimately is great, not only because we're fixing the state-local split, but that would have also translated to, over time, real property tax relief for Ohioans.
Yes, but that's not what happened, though. The numbers that were used to implement the last phase of the Fair School Funding Plan were inputs with 2022 data instead of updating it to 25 or 26, you know, whichever year you want to take. Leaders in both the House and Senate, your Republican colleagues who lead the Senate, said that the 2026 numbers were just far too expensive, not possible to fit into the budget. Did you think that they were too expensive? Was there no room in the budget for these numbers?
Well, no, there was room in the budget. And this gets to another sticking point of mine. So, you know, if you look into it, Senator Kent Smith, who's from Cleveland, he's also a Democrat. He's, you know, so this was a bipartisan bill. We had Senate Bill 190, which we called a good deal for Ohio. We went through this list of, you know, property tax or not property, excuse me, tax expenditures and various other taxes throughout the state to find money to do the entirety of the property tax circuit breaker. Now, that's not really related to what we're talking about here, except for the fact that the property tax circuit breaker was roughly, you know, $800 or $900 million per fiscal year. That if we had used those savings, and there were other programs in that bill, we could have easily used the money from the savings from a bill like that to completely fund the Fair School Funding Formula. And that would have been in addition to the income tax cut. Now, another way that we could have done that is to simply have not done the income tax cut and put that into public education funding. It wouldn't have been dollar for dollar enough to have gotten the entirety of the Fair School Funding Formula, but it would have gotten very close. And I think between some other tax reform, we could have gotten it done. So what it really boiled down to is a choice. And for me, in that budget, it just, you know, the way that we went was philosophically not where I was.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, I mean, you know, some would call it you broke ranks with your Republican colleagues. And you're the vice chair of the Education Committee. So I have to assume, did you have some heated debates with the other members related to this? Because it all kind of ties together. As you said, if you cut income taxes, you have to find it somewhere else. So it does all fit together. Are you in the minority of the majority party here?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have said that there were heated arguments on this. I mean, I did submit my amendments. I sent out you know, an email Senate-wide saying, hey, look, here's a, you know, version of the Fair School Funding Formula that did the inputs that had, you know, a temporary gain cap in order to phase this in, you know, over another cycle, which would have done it in a cheaper fashion, at least right out of the gate, would have smoothed out the big jump in cost. But, you know, when it was clear that the caucus wasn't going to go that way, you know, I wasn't about to pitch a fuss on the floor. You know, I remained silent for what it was worth on that. Though if people asked, I would tell them, you know, that was part of it. But, you know, going forward, I mean, the Senate Education Committee doesn't really deal with school funding as much. It's more of a policy-centric committee, even though it, you know, historically it has seen school funding debates go through it. So, I mean, it wasn't heated. I do think that there were members that, you know, were certainly sympathetic to what I was doing. But the budget is also an enormous document with a number of components, you know, spanning literally every nook and cranny of state government. There might have been members that felt similarly to me that, you know, might have come up and said, look, we got a ton on affordable housing. We got a ton on public safety. We couldn't justify voting no when we got that. So it's a more complicated picture than just, you know, dynamics in the caucus.
This is Untangled from All Sides in WOSU. We're talking about how much it costs to pay for Ohio's K-12 schools and who's paying for it with Republican State Senator Lewis Blessing from Hamilton County. And he is the vice chair of the Senate Education Committee, as we were just saying. So when Ohio school funding was ruled unconstitutional 30 years ago, the court said that the state had to have a base funding on a methodology that determined what the cost to educate different types of children was, meaning not everyone gets the same amount, but truly what it costs to educate each child in their circumstance. And so the court said that it should be those parameters, not what the state is willing to pay. But are you afraid that after with what happened with this budget and the House Speaker basically said it's too expensive to pay for the proper inputs, are we unconstitutional again? We used outdated inputs. So it seems that sounds to me like we're paying what the state's willing to pay.
Well, I mean, that's a tough question to answer simply because, you know, for it to be ruled unconstitutional, we'd have to be sued. We'd have to wind up in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, obviously, today is quite different than it was, roughly 30 years ago. So it's entirely possible that, you know, if a lawsuit was initiated and it made it all the way up to the top, the Supreme Court could say, in fact, that it is constitutional. So, you know, for me, I tend to worry less about that and try to focus on really the ethos of, you know, the thorough and efficient clause of the Constitution, which to me simply meant that every child shall have access to a solid public education, irrespective of where they live or what their wealth level is. And, you know, for me, just anecdotally looking at where we stand from the surrounding states, it starts to get into a more practical matter in that, hey, they're doing more at the state level. The state has a much larger economy of scale. We can do more at that level and really sort of shift the burdens away from the locals on something like this, which, you know, again, a lot of these rural communities or urban communities are quite poor. They have difficulty doing a lot of this funding on our own. You know, to me, it's less about, you know, the Constitution here and more about just, hey, this is, as a practical matter, the better way to go. And, oh, by the way, our surrounding states, you know, just by virtue of what they're doing, would agree.
So the state share of what it pays for school funding versus what local community pays, the state share is the lowest rate it's been in decades, as you said. Lawmakers are doing a ton of work right now to lower property taxes, but I feel like that's not going to fix this imbalance. Simple math just says the way to fix this is the state pays more so that districts don't have to increase property taxes. Am I simplifying it too much to say the state needs to pay more?
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I, you know, as the younger folks would say, 100%, you know, I agree. And I think there's an implicit assumption with what a lot of what is being done in Columbus is, well, we're not going to spend state money. We're shifting around local dollars. Implicit in that approach is that, hey, schools are just flush with cash and, you know, they need to return that to the taxpayers. And, you know, frankly, I am sympathetic to, the plight of a number of property tax owners or excuse me, property taxpayers in the state of Ohio. But, you know, we have to bear in mind that, you know, school board members, treasurers, superintendents, to assume that these people are spendthrifts, I think is a faulty assumption here. I think if their cash reserves are high, it's because they know, well, look, the state's not pitching in what it might pitch in, you know, elsewhere throughout the country. We have to go to the ballot for literally every single increase outside of inside millage or 20 mils. So the most prudent, rational, and dare I say conservative thing that they can do is have a high cash balance to avoid, you know, getting caught up where they're in debt and can't pay their bills. And, you know, so for me, I think long term fixing this really is as simple as having the state do more not putting a requirement on the locals other than, look, I think just organically, they say, well, if the state's legitimately putting more money in for school funding and that paradigm has shifted, I mean, do you think that they would go to the ballot for a tax increase? I don't. Mm-hmm. I think most of them would say, you know, we're happy to continue on with renewals, you know, which aren't tax increases. They just continue on with the same amount. And I think over time, that balance would become healthier, closer to 50-50 where it should be. It would obviously take time, but I think that's literally all you have to do if you want to get, you know, 70-80% of the problem solved.
Yeah. So what is the school district to do? How are they supposed to get the lawmakers to give them more money? You're one of them. You sound like one who would do it if it was up to just you, but it's not, obviously.
Well, that's where I'm wondering how all this plays out. I mean, so a lot of the property tax reform, I mean, and there is a lot, you know, coming out of the House. There's two that just came over Senate side. So, you know, obviously there are going to be a number of hearings on those. There are a number of pieces in the budget as well. But, you know, if I'm right, or I should say, if we're right about this, that, you know, shifting around local dollars doesn't, in fact, fix the problem, and that these folks really were good fiscal stewards, then you're going to see a couple things happen. You're going to see, you know, schools cut services, one. Two, I think they, you know, are likely to go to the ballot. Three, if a lot of these things at the ballot fail, they go into fiscal emergency. And I think a lot of communities, particularly rural communities, and, you know, I got to be clear, you know, my district, being suburban in Cincinnati, not a lot of my school districts are on the floor. So some of these things dealing with the floor are really not going to affect my district as much. However, a lot of my colleagues represent rural areas, of which the schools are your largest employers. So I think if this really kind of blows up and turns out to be ineffective, I think you're going to have a lot of angry constituents, a lot of people asking like, hey, we wanted property tax relief. We feel like we got neither relief nor reform, and our schools are in deep trouble. So I think they'd be angry there. And frankly, this is the same sort of ethos that was in place in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s over the House Bill 920, you know, tax reduction factor argument the last time that we had an inflationary crisis. Those tax reduction factors, you know, I'm sure at the time were sold as, hey, no unvoted increases. This is going to solve our problems. All it led to was, well, a lot more levies at the ballot, and nothing changed in terms of the state and local split. I mean, it got maybe a little bit better there, but in the end, it didn't solve anything. So I think there's historical precedent that it's not going to solve anything.
I've heard from a few people during this series that, you know, more than $1 billion in the budget went to charter schools, more than $1 billion went to private school vouchers. And there are those that said that if you just cut both of those even in half or by a third, there's nearly $1 billion that you could have given to public schools. What do you say to something like that?
So there's some nuance there, because charter schools are, in fact, public schools. But I think to some degree, you know, there needs to be a recognition that, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, school choice is actually somewhat popular. And now that's not to say that these, you know, what was done was the right reform. So using vouchers, for example, when you have, you know, basically everybody in the state, because there's two types of you know, we'll just stick with ed choice for now, mm-hmm. traditional ed choice and income-based ed choice. Anybody that's in a failing school district, irrespective of wealth, gets the traditional ed choice scholarship. Anybody that's less than 450% of the federal poverty level, you know, gets the income-based ed choice scholarship, with that declining curve above 450% federal poverty level. The problem is there is that that's effectively everybody, and it's not really means tested in a way that's really practical. I recall reading 450% of federal poverty level is something like 150 grand for a family of four. Well, that's, you know, I can't wager as to what percentile of Ohioans are below that. But, you know, I will say this, it's certainly to the right of the bell curve. So it's expensive. And at the same time, it's really moving away from the original target audience, which was, you know, very poor families in poorly performing school districts. So, I mean, is reform necessary in those spaces? Absolutely. But I think we will always be with them. But I think, or they, those programs to some degree will always be with us. The catch is, though, in terms of testimony, Scott DeMauro, who was the OEA chief at the time.
The Ohio said, Education Association, the union. Yeah.
Correct. He said, look, you know, we don't have any beef if you guys are going to do these things as long as you're willing to do the entirety of the fair school funding formula. So I think even he recognized that, look, you know, if we do this, we're, you know, it's going into education. That's a good thing. So I kind of took that to heart that, like, hey, had we not done the income tax cut and we had done some of the other tax reform, we could have had our cake and eaten it mm-hmm. too in that respect. So I think in the end, I don't think either of those two things will ever be entirely gone. But if I had to guess, I think they might be curtailed in the future. And by curtailed, I mean, you know, they might not get a lot more funding. The bounds with which you see the Ed Choice Scholarship, for example, work within, they may not, you know, they may not become fully universal. I think those are the things that you might see with that. Although, again, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't point out, state of Kentucky, had voted 2-1 for President Trump, but at the same time, there was a ballot initiative to try to get, school vouchers to be in place in Kentucky, and that went down 2-1. So, I mean, there's a lot of dynamics that could be at play with something like this, and we are a referendum-initiated statute and initiated constitutional amendment state. So, I mean, who knows what could happen in that space?
In the minute or so that we have left, I've been asking a lot of people throughout this series, we don't have it figured out on how to fairly pay for schools. Is there a better way? What's your better way? If you could, change the way things go forward, what would you like to see happen at the state level when it comes to school funding?
Oh, wow. Certainly doing the fair school funding formula, full stop. For future discussions, I have a constitutional amendment proposal coming up that would allow Ohio to have land value taxation. And this is different. I think this is one that the business community could get behind, as well as a lot of, folks in urban areas. And there's a lot of nuance to explain that. But, you know, we could avoid some of the other issues that, you know, we've run into with property taxation, in the sense that, you know, we have all these levies, we have, you know, tax reduction factors and 20 mil floors. Yet the state of Ohio, when we budget, if we had to increase or decrease taxes, we could do it by simple majority. I think you'd find a lot of this complication going away if school districts, cities, townships, villages, counties, you name it, could levy, increase or decrease property taxes, for example, by simple majority and didn't have to go to the ballot. But again, you do have democratic oversight because of the elected officials overseeing that.
Oh, so like an elected school board would be able to levy the tax. Is that what you mean?
Correct. Correct. And again, if they did a terrible job, they're voted out and somebody who will do a better job would be there to replace them, which I think would be much better. It's how we do our budgeting in Ohio. I think it would help their bond rating. I think it would also avoid, frankly, voter anger, because I think, you know, a number of folks are out there that are like, I'm tired of voting on things and might just say no, even if the levy was really needed. All of that goes away in a situation like that. Unfortunately, you would need a constitutional amendment to change that.
The school boards in my home state of Pennsylvania, they can vote. They vote for taxes. And then the people who live in Pennsylvania vote for the school board. Yeah.
So that's, yeah, I think that's a much better way to go about it.
All right. Well, when you introduce that and it's all talked about, we'll have you back to talk about that. How about we've been talking about paying for Ohio's K-12 schools with State Senator Lewis Blessing. Thank you so much for your time today, Senator.
My pleasure, Amy. Thank you very much.
This is Untangled from All Sides and WOSU. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, explains it in a way that's easier to understand. And this season, we're tackling the cost of learning. In 2021, the Fair School Funding Plan was passed. It was a bipartisan school funding formula intended to modernize and improve the way Ohio pays for its public K-12 schools. The formula was implemented completely for 4 years, but in the most recent budget, the formula was altered slightly. And public school advocates say the state is now underfunding schools by nearly $2 billion over the next 2 years. To get her take on the creation of the plan and what happened to it, we have one of the sponsors of the Fair School Funding Plan, State Representative Brad Rose Sweeney. She's a Democrat from Westlake near Lake Erie and Cleveland. She represents portions of Western Cuyahoga County. Welcome to All Sides, Representative Sweeney.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I wanted to start with the creation of the plan. It was bipartisan. It was created by a Democrat and a Republican. It was sponsored by a Democrat and a Republican. That seems very rare, especially around an issue like school funding. So how did you get it to come together?
So this was a culmination of not just the two individuals whose name appear on the final version, which is myself and the Republican sponsor, Jamie Callender, but from the initial work of former Supreme Court Justice Bob Kupp, and who's a Republican, mm-hmm. and a former school teacher from Ashtabula County, John Patterson. They both served in the legislature and joined a group of superintendents and treasurers who were finally so sick of this prevalent problem for, at that point, over 20 years mm-hmm. of having a knowingly unconstitutional funding formula for one of the only explicit duties we have in the Ohio Constitution, which is it's not just a nice thing to do. It is an actual constitutional obligation for the state of Ohio to fund our schools. It was the work of those individuals who got together and said, we don't care about party. We don't care about, you know, you have an individual from a more rural districts. It got to the point at that point in the legislature where over 80% of our over 600 public school districts in the state weren't even getting the money that the broken unconstitutional formula said that they needed to get. And they decided to put not just trying to fix their own individual school districts or fix just for rural Ohio or for economically disadvantaged, but a complete overhaul of that system. And they formed what's now called the Fair School Funding Work Group. These are treasurers and superintendents and people who have supported this, teachers, educators, parents. It would have never gotten done without countless public servants and advocates who did tremendous amount of work to come up with a new plan. And by the time I was in the legislature, John Patterson had been term limited, and I had been asked to carry on this legacy mm-hmm. and get it across the finish line. And I'm very proud to say that we implemented it into law.
So the formula took property values and the income of residents into consideration when determining how much the state would pay versus how much districts would need to raise on their own. So it did not give the same amount per child to every district. So you determined different types of inputs that were considered looking at the unique cost of educating each individual child. Is that right?
Correct. And I think it's really important to briefly describe the history of the funding formula and why the state Supreme Court said in a bipartisan ruling, meaning Republican and Democratic justices, ruled that it was unconstitutional, actually for four different reasons. But very simply, some of the main tenets of why the way that we were funding schools for the majority of Ohio's history was this issue of an over-reliance on local property taxes and something that's called residual funding. And practically what the state was doing was funding all of our other obligations, our Medicaid, regular state government, what we're going to give to local governments, jails. And whatever we had left over, we just say, that's what we're going to give to education. We're going to divide it up, and that's what we're going to give to every single student in the state. Obviously, there was a little bit more complexity to that, but the main point and the main change, the two biggest changes that we believe that we produced a constitutional funding formula was actually connecting what it actually costs to educate a child in Ohio and trying to get off of this over-reliance on property taxes. It absolutely blew my mind when I entered the legislature and sat on the Finance Committee when I learned that the way that we were funding schools was actually made up. We never tried previously before the Fair School Funding Plan to say, let's just start from the basis. What does it cost to educate a child in Ohio? So everything within the Fair School Funding Plan is not the dream scenario, what, you know, paving the schools in gold. It is just what it just cost, bare minimum, for our schools. And so that is where the data and inputs come from that had never existed previously. And the second component was this over-reliance on property taxes. And so one of the main changes was adding income into the calculation. So how it works is we come up with a number with what we're going to give each individual school district on a per pupil basis based on all this real data that was conducted by a nonpartisan group through the Republican Department of Education, and come up with that number. But then how much does the state pay versus the locals? You determine that by what we call local capacity. Previously, we were just looking at home values, but we know that home values rise. That doesn't mean that homeowners all of a sudden have more money in their pockets. And so one of the big positive changes was adding income to kind of give a better look of really what is the true or a more true capacity of that community. And so we have the real inputs of a more personalized formula that is actually reflective of what it really cost and a more accurate definition of what that local share is. And it is truly light years ahead of our previous plan.
So let's talk about what happened with the last budget cycle, because I mentioned that at the beginning, the Fair School Funding Plan was it was not fully implemented in the last budget cycle. The plan used costs from 2022 instead of updating it for 2025. So how do you feel this impacted things?
So when we were able to get the formula into the budget 4 years ago, what those studies said, that we were underfunding the base costs. And I think it's really important that we understand what base cost means, because base cost is what a typical student is that has no other additional needs. With that, those studies said at that point in 2020, we needed another $2 billion into the formula. But there's other needs our students have, such as if you're economically disadvantaged, if you're gifted, special needs, or if English is your first language. There's all these other components. We also studied all of them underfunded. So we are just trying to start to get this base cost implemented. At that time, $2 billion to reflect the needs of 2020. In the spirit of the General Assembly and compromise, we decided to do a six-year phase-in to get that $2 billion updated. But it was on the values of 2020. It's so important to acknowledge we had the $2 billion at that time. I know it sounds like a lot of money. It's not my opinion. It's what it just cost to educate children. But in order to get it done, we had a six-year phase-in. So we got years one and two into the first budget. The second budget, we got years three and four, and we were successful in also adding the 2022 inputs to start to get onto this basis. And basically what this budget did was gave the last 2 years of that first implementation, but they did not update those inputs. And that's the big factor, is if we get so far away from what it actually costs educated children, we're going to be just where we started, and if not in a worse place, which some could argue that we are steeply going into a worse place than we were 30 years ago when the Supreme Court said that we were unconstitutionally relying too heavily on property tax owners.
This is Untangled, the Cost of Learning from All Sides in WOSU. We're talking with State Representative Bride Rose Sweeney. She's a Democrat from Western Cuyahoga County. So during this whole process, House Speaker Matt Huffman had a press conference at one point where he criticized the Fair School funding formula and the plan. And he said that it did not take into account true costs. He said something about the plan did not take into account transportation costs, teacher salaries increasing. He said that the plan was a formula in the budget. It was not legislation. He had lots of different things to say. Is that true, that he could look at it differently?
Oh, absolutely. anyone can look at anything differently. I like to look at facts. And I want to be very clear that this formula is quite possibly the biggest achievement I will ever have. And I'm proud of that. But a formula doesn't do anything if there's not actual money into it. And so even if we fully funded the plan, it does not fix our schools, because we have all economically disadvantaged. We have gifted students we have to continue to look at. So to argue about, like, I don't want anyone to say that this is the silver bullet, but this is just the bare minimum. This is just what it cost. What it costs to educate children in Ohio. And I think there's this really, like, it's not just a nice to do. And when you hear this narrative that this plan is unsustainable, as if that we are giving every kid a VHR set and going to have every opportunity in the world, we are so far behind, when on the base cost said that we're underfunding kids by $2 billion. That is a lot of money. And when we needed another $2 billion, that's a lot of money. But we were so far behind, and we have never fully funded the schools. And when the state says it's unsustainable, teachers still have to get paid. Kids still have to get educated. The reality is that we push more of that onto local property tax owners. We have the highest levy, more levies before Ohio voters than anywhere in the country. That's not because our schools are so greedy and our kids have the best access to education. It is because the state has different, the majority has different priorities of what to spend money on. We had the money this budget to fully fund the schools. It wasn't like we were facing a massive deficit. We decided to give almost $2 billion away to the richest people in the state. We gave $600 million to a football team in my neck of the woods. So we had money to spend. The idea that it was unsustainable given that the majority felt that those other priorities of giving tax breaks to rich people was more of a priority than funding our schools.
So Huffman saying it was too expensive to implement the plan, but I feel like his comments are taking us back to this whole idea of dividing the money based on what the state is willing to pay rather than the actual cost of educating a child. So then doesn't him saying that it was too expensive to implement fully, doesn't that make this unconstitutional again?
I am no lawyer, but that is would be absolutely a fair interpretation of my perspective.
Okay. So, but it sounds to me overall like we need a new idea, because if the state won't pay more, right, and property taxpayers don't want to pay more, meaning that they're going to stop saying yes to levies at some point, they're going to stop saying yes to levies. So what do we do next? What do you think?
I don't think we need a new idea. And I think we should also acknowledge, I was told when I entered the legislature and when I decided to take on this task of something that people within my party, people outside of my party said, you can't, people have been trying to do that for 30 decades, almost before you were born. Mm. And we were told it was too hard to do. But we accomplished it. And we accomplished it in one of the worst minorities Democrats have ever been in, and one of the most polarizing times. The next budget, last GA, we got the largest increase into our public schools in the past 15 years. So this is a step in the wrong direction, but we should acknowledge that we can do hard things. And also, we didn't do those two remarkable things that are wildly popular because me and my sponsors were just some magical, we had some magic wands. It didn't happen just because we willed it to happen. It happened because we had the public, the people, and we had districts from all across the state of Ohio, rural districts, urban districts, high wealth districts, low wealth districts, all suffering from the inaction of a General Assembly who has refused to prioritize education. And that coalition of saying, we need to stick together, not just fight high wealth districts just trying to get their piece, urban districts just trying to fight for their own. Of we built a real community, and an understanding is that we as a society and the education community, but also the business community, that we need to have a successful education system so that we are producing successful Ohioans who have the chance to be whatever they choose to be. So I believe in the formula. It is out of the House past version. They actually tried, they did remove the entire formula. And because of the work of the education community and activists all across Ohio, Republican and Democrat, demanded to put that formula that took 30 years for us to get in, that for the first time actually attempted to give the money that the schools bare minimum needed. This was a step back, but that formula is still in there. And I, as long as I'm elected, and probably when I'm not elected, this fight is always going to continue. We are so far behind, but it is still possible to right this wrong. We're just further behind than I'd like to be, but we've made such good progress, and we have to continue to fight for the kids, because to me, there is nothing more important.
Lawmakers right now are doing a lot of work on property taxes. The idea is to lessen the burden on homeowners. And it's all property taxes, not just the school ones. But when it comes down to it, schools are the highest percentage of property taxes. So there's a lot of ideas floating out there. You're the ranking member of the House Finance Committee. Do you have a favorite one? What's your
Oh, I absolutely do. Property taxes are too high. We need to lower people's property taxes. And it is unequivocally the state of Ohio, the state legislature's fault for having this crisis evolve. The solution is to help those who are on the verge, who are most impacted, who are quite literally at the risk of being taxed out of their homes because the government has created this problem that is not really reflective of the realities of what people can afford. One of the most popular programs we have is the homestead exemption that targets seniors who are in fixed income. So when their home values rise and those property taxes rise with it, their incomes didn't rise because that's not how fixed incomes work, that we allow to give a break on seniors. Over the past 15 years or 15 years ago, Democrats and Republicans supported every single senior in the state of Ohio receiving a homestead exemption. It was tiered based on your home value, so those wealthier, but you got something regardless of where you were at the state of what you made. In those past 15 years under this majority, they've made decisions to continue to chip away at providing that because the state was basically filling that gap. That is one of the most popular bills. If we could maybe vote in private, I think the vast majority of everyone in the General Assembly would vote for that. The problem, the fight we've been having is the state does not want to pay for a real homestead exemption because it costs about $1 billion, which is about 1% of our overall state budget. It sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money, but we gave $1 billion away. We could have used that money to help people afford to stay in their homes. But again, this legislature chose not to.
So how do we lower the property taxes without taking money away from school budgets? That seems impossible.
The state chipping in their money to do so. So all of the pieces of policy that have passed that address this issue, they are working around the edges. They're trying to find ways to cap the growth of levies, making it harder for levies to pass, eliminating what types of levies can pass, allowing budget commissions to, if once the voters approve a levy, to say, you know what, taxes are too high, we're going to undo that levy, even though the schools maybe made a really good case and that community agreed to pay more in taxes, which maybe there is some merit to looking at how we maintain taxes, but it's a failure to acknowledge why this problem exists. It exists because we have nonpartisan studies that say that we're underfunding our public schools by over $2 billion. Kids still need to get educated. Lights still need to turn on when people go to school. So the schools, because of state action, are forced to go to the levies and keep asking. And most people want to support their public schools. And now we're in this scenario where people cannot afford to pass one more levy, even though they support their schools. And so we've seen some of the, we are the most over-levied state in the country, and we have some of the highest property tax rates. That is only because the state is not paying its fair share, and most people don't see that connection.
Well, in the minute we have left, throughout this series on school funding, I've been asking my guests here and there if there's a better way, and if you had a magic wand and could make something happen tomorrow, what would be your better way to pay for K-12 schools? Is your answer having the state pay more? What's your magic wand?
Absolutely. We had money in this budget. The idea that we didn't, I sit on the finance committee, don't let any single politician tell you we did not have the money to fully fund the schools. Funding schools equals property tax relief. We could have fully funded our schools and given every senior in this state real property tax relief just by not giving a tax giveaway up to $2 billion to the top 1% of earners that over 80% of Ohioans didn't see a dime in income tax.
That's the flattening the income tax you're referring to.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we made decisions that we said, oh, we could have counted on that $2 billion, but we decided to give it back to the top 1% in the state of Ohio. If we can do that, and we could have still afforded to pay for our schools and to give homestead relief, then fine. But it came at the cost. That is what this legislature decided to do. We're not in a great recession. We're not facing a once-in-a-year pandemic where our hands could have really been tied. This was a very intentional decision. And so there is a real hope in that when this was a decision that caused these problems means that we can also undo these and we can have a more fair tax code to make sure that we have the tax revenue to make sure that we're not underfunding our schools and pushing more and more burden onto homeowners.
We've been talking with State Representative Brad Rose Sweeney, a Democrat from Western Cuyahoga County. Thank you so much for your time today, Representative.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been Untangled, the Cost of Learning from All Sides in WOSU. If you missed any part of the series, subscribe to the Untangled podcast and listen back to our previous 5 episodes. You can find them all at WOSU.org/untangled as well. There is more to say about school funding, and things will change as state lawmakers continue to try to adjust the way property taxes are levied. But we're going to leave it here for now. For Untangled and All Sides, I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for listening.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.